The prologue is called Aperture. I awake on January 29th, 1993. It is less than a month until my 24th birthday. It's Friday, and I'm looking forward to the weekend. As on most mornings before heading to the office, I go to the gym and then return home to shower, dress, eat breakfast. At 9:15, after taking a last sip of orange juice and double-checking that I have everything I need for the day, datebook, journal, notes for an article I'm writing, cash, I'm ready to go. The telephone rings. Hello? Hello, is Sarah Safi in there? This is Sarah. I guess that it's a magazine editor calling about work. Sarah, my name is Hannah Morgan. I think I'm your birth mother. Chapter 1, Awakening. I remember being 7 years old. It was not long after my mother, Nancy, had died. I was alone in the living room of our old apartment, poking around in the leather top desk by the windows. The yellow light in my memory is of late afternoon, early evening, and the bustle-free air suggests a weekend, a Sunday. I pulled open the wooden drawer to find a black datebook with the year 1969 embossed on the front in gold. Curious and still young enough to think unfailingly of myself first, I looked up my birthday and was proud to see, penciled in my father's rushed but tidy hand on February 23rd, Sarah Ruth is born. I continued to flip through the book and was startled to find written sometime in late April, Sarah Ruth comes home. I mulled over the 2-month discrepancy for several seconds before calling to my father to ask why I had taken so long to come home from the hospital. I perched on the leather hassock facing him as he sat in the large red armchair. Even when I was young, he took me seriously, was attentive to my questions, and straightforward in his answers. For the first time, he told me the story of my adoption. "Mommy and I tried to have you on our own, but we weren't able to," he began. I didn't yet know exactly how babies were made, but I had seen pregnant women before, on the street, mothers of friends. "So we adopted you, which means that someone else gave you to us to be our daughter." He went on to talk about filling out the forms. "Most people are so desperate for a child, they say they'd be overjoyed with any baby and don't put down preferences." He smiled then and smugly recalled, "But Mommy and I looked at each other and said, well, we really want a little girl." He said they'd also requested that the birth parents be college graduates, or at least in college. As much as my father has always been steadfast in proclaiming me his true daughter, birth daughter or no, he must have believed that intelligence is somewhat genetic. "We were asking for you in particular. You were meant to be with Mommy and me," he said, "and I did have the sense of being carefully selected, deliberately ordered, as if I were a Safian because I met their specifications. The message that I was supremely wanted overrode any potential feelings of being unwanted by my original set of parents. We discussed how I had been chosen and brought home, not how I had been abandoned. Mostly, however, I absorbed this new information the same way that I had taken in my mother's death, turning numb in the face of its enormity, as though the revelation belonged to someone else, or were unfolding outside of reality in a movie or a book. My feelings seeped out, displaced, haphazard. The impact of this initial conversation about my adoption was gradual. I soon discovered that there was another adopted girl in my class at school, and that being adopted was regarded as only slightly weirder than having divorced parents, which had become practically as common as having parents who were still together. The fact that my mother had died was deemed exotic, perhaps because it was tragic, while being adopted wasn't necessarily so. Being a child who spent much of the time in a make-believe world, I responded primarily through fantasy. The news didn't preoccupy my daily life, but whenever I was in the mood, I would let myself drift into imagining who my birth parents might be. As a little girl, I pictured fairy tale characters, Cinderella and Prince Charming, Snow White and Prince Charming, Rapunzel and Prince Charming, or modest living but always very beautiful peasant men and women, ruby-lipped and fair-skinned, frolicking in the glistening green hills of the countryside, fetching water from the winking stream, living life robustly, passionately, purely. As an adolescent, my thoughts turned to the celebrities du jour. Was Marie Osmond my birth mother? Was John Travolta my birth father? As an adult, whenever I passed people on the street with a coloring and build similar to mine, I looked them over closely, or else I cataloged people I knew, teachers, friends of my parents, and wondered. With a single phone call on an otherwise ordinary morning, this life of vague curiosity was instantly transformed. "Oh my God," I whispered, receiver clutched in hand. Tears sprang to my eyes as I made my way to a chair. A pause. My birth mother started to speak, her voice soft and shaky, but forthright. She didn't sound like a New Yorker, an uptight urban dweller. Underneath the surface unease, I sensed a core of calmness. "I'm sorry to startle you by calling on the phone," Hannah hesitantly began. "But I worried that if I sent a letter and got no answer, I wouldn't know if you had gotten the letter and didn't want to write back, or if you hadn't gotten the letter because I'd written to the wrong person." "Mm-hmm," I answered, reduced for a while to one word or one sound responses. I was so preoccupied with the fact that we were speaking at all, it was difficult to concentrate on what we were speaking about. To ground myself, I grabbed a scrap of notepaper off my desk and scribbled down key facts while we talked. Hannah told me that she had been 21 years old when she gave birth to me at Staten Island Hospital, and that I had weighed only 5 pounds. "It was an easy pregnancy and an easy delivery, so chances are you will have easy pregnancies and deliveries too, that is, if you want to have children." "Oh, I definitely want to have children," I gushed automatically, surprising myself. Hannah said that she and my birth father, Adam Lader, had met in college and that I had been conceived soon after graduation. So my father had been granted his wish of college-educated birth parents, after all, I thought, in passing. The link between this live voice and a preference on a form felt oddly arbitrary. What if Marvin and Nancy Safian hadn't written that in? Would I have been placed with someone else? Hannah went on to admit that toward the end of the pregnancy, she had begun having second thoughts about giving me up, but believed it was too late to change her mind. "I have another shock for you," she said. "I married to your birth father, and we have 3 other children, Renee, age 14, Lucy, 10, and Samuel, 6, my full biological siblings." "Oh, that's so wonderful," I heard myself saying. "Then I can visit you all at once." Their family lived in Hanover, New Hampshire, where Hannah worked as a potter and Adam as a draftsman. I tried to absorb this barrage of information. The phone call was creating a rift in me. While one part was interacting, the other part was unaffected, on the outside, looking in. Then Hannah revealed the name she had given me, the name that appeared on my original birth certificate, Susan Morgan. I turned the strange name over in my head as if I were meeting a new person. "Could you tell me about your family?" she asked next. "I feel like I've been doing all the talking." In a split second before responding, I considered how best to relay the most painful piece of the story. I felt oddly protective of Hannah already. I had no intention of startling or hurting her and was loath to contribute to any regrets she had about relinquishing me. At the same time, I also felt protective of my family. I didn't want to give Hannah the wrong impression that I'd grown up neglected in a broken household. I'd always been cared for, loved without bounds. In answering this woman who had given me life, I had to be gentle, but also direct. "Well, one important thing you should know," I offered, "is that my mother died when I was 6. Hannah took in a short, sharp breath. "That's one of the things birth mothers always fear, that something happens to the adoptive parents," she said. "And then Adam's mother died when he was 6, too." I was stunned by this unexpected parallel, but I blinked and recovered, going on to explain that my father had remarried when I was 10, and that he and his new wife, Kathy, had had 2 children together within 2 years, my brother, Maxwell, and my sister, Rachel Ann. I reassured Hannah that I loved my family dearly. My father had been and continued to be my anchor, and Kathy, whom I considered mom, had picked up where Nancy left off and mothered me devotedly with strength and sensitivity. "What do you look like?" Hannah asked later in the conversation. "I have dark brown hair, wavy, about shoulder length, and green eyes." "Yes, I think we were told that you had green eyes. All of us but Sam have green eyes. He has blue eyes. Are you left-handed by any chance?" "Yes, I'm left-handed, and so are Lucy and Sam." "Oh, is that genetic?" "I think so. You know, your birth father is 6'4". 6'4"? I'm only 5'5". What happened?" "Well, I'm not quite 5'3". "Oh, I see. Thanks a lot." We shared our first laugh. I told her that I had known I was adopted for almost as long as I could remember, and that I had always planned to seek out my birth parents. She asked if I had ever expressed this interest to my father, and if so, how he had reacted. I said that when I had brought it up to him hypothetically, he had answered that he would be as supportive and informative as he could, but that he didn't want to be personally involved. Hannah gave me their address and phone number, saying that I could call any time. "Would it be all right if Adam called you? I feel badly that I'm getting to talk to you without him here." "Why don't I try to call him instead?" I quickly responded. "Maybe over the weekend." Hannah asked, imparting, "Did you ever think you would pick up the phone and it would be me?" After pausing to think, I replied simply, "No, because I always assumed I would be the one making the call." I carefully returned the receiver to its cradle and fixated on it for a beat. Still sitting, I took a deep breath and switched my gaze to a point on the wall for several seconds. The room was very quiet in that palpable way that comes after there has been loud noise. Unclear of my emotions in this moment, shock, confusion, loss, I nonetheless felt them physically tingling through me. After several minutes, not knowing what else to do, I wiped my eyes, pulled on my backpack, and headed out into the cold, bright day. I watched with a mix of envy and amazement the people bustling past, shower fresh hair still glistening, hands balancing hot paper coffee cups bearing the Greek-lettered declaration, "We are happy to serve you," on their way to work, to appointments, to a normal end of a normal week. Once at the office, I said quick, perfunctory good mornings as I made my way to my desk, where I sat and stared at my articles, letters turning into hieroglyphics, text blurring into two fuzzy, distant columns before my unfocusing eyes. I finally broke through my trance and called my father, who was home for the day. At the first sound of his voice, all at once I began to cry in earnest. Between sobs, I told him about Hannah's phone call, and he said to come right over. I pleaded family emergency to my editor, the emergency being my newfound confusion about the concept of family, and rushed out. As I walked from the subway to my parents' house, I was surprised that their block, the stoop, the tree in front of their brownstone, all looked a bit different, as though I were seeing them for the first time. Through a kitchen window, I saw Dad sitting, waiting. Noticing me, he smiled and got up to let me in. Relief flowed through me as we hugged and I breathed in his warm, fatherly smell of soap and coffee and cigarettes. I sat down at the table, running my hands along its butcher block solidity, and gradually began to feel oriented again in these familial surroundings. My father had a look of concern, but not of surprise. "So, tell me what happened." I took him from the ring of the telephone through the entire conversation in as much detail as I could muster. I was dry-eyed, matter-of-fact, exhausted, and wired at once, like the sensation after staying up all night. When I mentioned my birth name as Susan Morgan, he nodded. "Yes, I remember. Susan was one of the few things we knew. That, and that the birth mother was Jewish, being that we adopted you through a Jewish adoption agency." The confirmation quelled my fears that this woman might be an imposter or simply mistaken. As we talked, I felt deeply connected to my father, sure that he was my parent and not these strangers who had unexpectedly burst into my life. Who were they to me? He and I have always shared an especially close bond, but usually it is simply a silent understanding. Discussing my birth parents and the circumstances of my adoption brought our bond to the surface. Perhaps we were even clinging to our connection because this new element was potentially threatening. It didn't have a place in our world of father and daughter. After a while, I called Mom at work. I had been open with my father, but cautiously so, afraid that he would feel defensive about my birth parents' sudden emergence. With my mother, I could speak more freely, because even though the Laters presented a potential threat to her as well, she wasn't the one who had adopted me. Outwardly, she reacted with curiosity and support. That evening, however, she confessed that after hanging up, she had gone into a friend's office to ask, why did she have to call Sarah? Why couldn't she have contacted us instead so at least we could have acted as an intermediary? But as my mother was admitting this, I felt glad that Hannah had called me and not them. Each of us wanted to soften the blow for the other. Mom paused then and said, I appreciate a birth mother's desire to know, but I never would have called my child without warning, she mused. If you two had met by chance, it would have been one thing, but when one person has years to prepare and the other receives the call, all of a sudden, it's an unfair advantage. Because I already liked Hannah from our single half-hour-long interaction, I felt the urge to defend her, to understand her reasons for calling me. What would you have done if Hannah had contacted you instead? No opinion, my father answered tersely. I may or may not have talked to her. I would have called you first. Then he added, I certainly wouldn't have started blabbing to someone who said she was my daughter's mother. Mom said that if Hannah had called her or written her a letter, we as a family could have discussed the possibility of pursuing a relationship, whether I wanted to respond, and how. I decided not to call my birth parents back yet. It was too soon. I needed time to digest what had happened and to decide what I wanted to do about it. But in their eagerness, they didn't afford me that space. On Monday evening, again as I was on my way out, the phone rang. Hey, Sarah, this is Adam Later, your birth father. My stomach leapt in panic. As the impact of both phone calls hit me at once, I felt not just startled, but invaded. We exchanged much of the same information that Hannah and I had, what we looked like, general overviews of our lives. When I admitted my feelings of shock and self-protectiveness, Adam apologized for prompting these reactions and then stuttered, clearly moved. I can't believe I'm talking to you. I'd drive down to New York to meet you on 5 minutes' notice and leave after 5 minutes if that was what you wanted. I tried to maintain a pleasant composure on the surface, but inside I was churning. No, please don't do that, not yet, I answered, drumming my fingers on the kitchen table, laughing shrilly with disbelief at the extreme situation I was being thrust into. I'd like to meet you someday, but right now I'm overwhelmed, even by these phone calls. Why don't we write instead, for the time being, I continued, choosing my words deliberately, trying to let him down easy. I can't have an emotional upheaval every time the phone rings. It's hard to be taken by surprise like that. Letters would be much more manageable for me just while we figure all this out. Would that be okay with you? He asked whether I felt comfortable sending photographs along with these letters, but I answered that I wasn't even ready for that yet. He said he understood, stressing, we want to do whatever is best for you, whatever you want. But I thought I could sense his disappointment, his sense of urgency deflated. After we hung up, I paused long enough for it to dawn on me that this wasn't about a single phone call, an isolated incident, but about an ongoing process. I'd had my fantasy heritage whisked out from under me, like in the old magic trick, only I wasn't left intact as the place setting is supposed to be after the tablecloth has been yanked away. Then, flustered, I rushed out. The following week, I received a single white business-sized envelope addressed in neat capital letters. After staring at the return address for several moments, I carefully opened the envelope to find two separate letters, both a couple of pages long, typed and hand-signed. I took a deep breath and plunged in. So that's the beginning of the book and of my journey. And I hesitated in the middle. I don't know if you noticed, but I don't normally read, I mean, at bookstores where it's not adoption-specific venues, I don't normally read that section. about my parents' reactions, but I thought it was relevant here. And I know I'm just giving a slice of this, and the whole point of the book is to take the reader through what turned out to be a 3-year journey towards reunion. And in the interim, we only wrote these letters, and I excerpt many of them in the book. And even though they don't make up a great portion of the book, they do serve as its chronological backbone, connecting phone call to reunion. And because this first half of my workshop is about the phenomenon of being found, I wanted to just read that section to show the initial impact and all of the negative, positive, and neutral emotions that, whether it's a birth mother or father or other birth relative or an adoptee, can feel upon being found, especially suddenly, like with a phone call. And that there are negative feelings, and also that there are, that this connects to the second part of the workshop, that there are a lot of loyalty issues involved, that already, even in this first weekend, these first couple of days following the initial contact, I was feeling guilt towards my birth parents. You know, as I said, I could sense my birth father's urgency deflated, that I didn't say, oh great, come on down, or oh great, I'll come up and meet you right away. And I felt badly that I was doing that to him, because it was so clear that they were so excited that they'd found me at last, and that he couldn't believe he was speaking to me on the phone. But then, on the other hand, I was getting these messages from my parents that my father would be supportive from a distance, that I wouldn't blab on the phone to someone who said that she was my daughter's mother, that I felt slightly more comfortable talking with my mother because I thought that she'd feel slightly less threatened by the emergence of these birth parents because she hadn't technically adopted me. You know, that there are all of these issues that come up right away. And it's a difficult situation for all members of the triad, or at least it's a challenging one, and it can be a very rewarding one for all members of the triad. But at this point anyway, I certainly felt like the adoptee caught in the middle of, and in the meantime thinking about myself and what I wanted, without having been prepared for it, that I would receive this phone call this morning. That it was literally out of the blue. I was wondering, before I get into some of the points I wanted to talk about, if I could, even just a show of hands, who is an adoptee here? Okay, and what about a birth parent? Okay, lots of birth parents. And any adoptive parents? Yes, okay, great, okay. And who is in reunion here? Who has already? Okay, most people, great, okay, great. And one more show of hands, who has been found? Who was the one who was found? Oh, just you. Okay, so most people were the ones who did the search, sort of? It was mutual?
It was SoundX.
Okay.
But there was a huge time lapse, so...
So you both came forward on your own, and then they made contacts?
I sent the SoundX form in around 87, and didn't have a reunion until 94.
Mm-hmm.
Turned 30, had my daughter 2 weeks later. 6 weeks later, got a letter from SoundX.
It does all happen at once, doesn't it? Yeah, really.
What a year.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, I was looking, but
right.
Kind of had forgotten.
You were a little busy.
I was busy.
Right, yeah, definitely. So wait, how much of a time was there between you registering and getting the letter?
You know, it's
87 to 94.
Okay.
I mean, there was you send it off, you go to the mailbox every day.
Yeah.
For 3 months,
you forget about it, yeah.
And then, okay, life goes on. That's not the way. And being pregnant, I was pregnant the same month that my birth mother was pregnant, April to January.
Mm.
So I'm obsessing about this, thinking, after I have this child, I have to complete this.
Mm-hmm.
I have her 2 weeks after I turn 30, and then get this letter 6 weeks later. It was spooky.
That is wild. Yeah.
How many? I also have full sibs.
Okay.
Many birth parents are married, so.
Okay, and you searched.
I'm just kind of amazed by, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but finding birth parents and the adoptee have siblings, because we have a daughter out there and she has 5 biological brothers.
Okay.
So I'm kind of amazed, because I didn't think there was that many out there.
Right, I know. Yeah, there are. It's unusual, but then, I mean, if I get a lot of mail from readers of the book, and a lot of them say that they have a somewhat similar situation, and it amazes me, too, that there are those situations.
I've heard of birth parents marrying after, but then separating.
Yeah.
But not staying together. That's the part that amazes me.
Yeah, well, mine didn't marry till 8 years after giving me up, and they had a pretty rocky period in between. They did break up for a time directly after. But they say, ultimately, that giving me up raised the stakes between them in a positive way, that perhaps it was going through that painful experience together was part of what kept them together, because they had been going out in college, but they weren't that serious, you know, and of course it became much more serious when she became pregnant and they had to face this decision and going through this experience. So in the short term, it was damaging to their relationship and they had to spend time apart and they dated other people, but ultimately they couldn't. I mean, whenever you go through a tragedy, I guess there's the, or a challenging experience, I should say, there's, on the one hand, how could you not be with that person? But then on the other hand, how could you be with that person, you know? And so in their case, it brought them back together. But it certainly brought up, I know that guilt feelings among birth parents aren't uncommon, but my birth mother says it brought up even more for her, you know, that she had kept her other children, and how could she have done that? You had a comment. Okay. And are you in contact with them?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
In the summer with them.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So, my brother's actually close to my age.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, see, mine are younger, but they're actually, their two oldest children, their two daughters are contemporaries of my brother and sister in my family, pretty much, because my oldest birth sister is about a year and a half older than my brother. And then my sister is about a year older than their second daughter, my birth parents' second daughter, because, you know, my father remarried when I was 10, and then he and my mother now had children, and also my birth parents waited to marry and have children. So that's strange. And also my mother now, my father's second wife, is 16 years younger than my father, and so she's actually a contemporary of my birth mother's. You know, it's very common that the adoptive parents are considerably older. And my birth mother did have me right after college, so she was very young, but my birth mother's actually a couple months older than my mother, but they're, you know, contemporaries. They graduated from college the same year. They graduated from college the year I was born, so.
Did they ever meet?
No, my two families haven't met yet. I'll talk more about that in the second half, I guess, but yeah, they haven't met yet. So was there a hand over here too? Yeah. Okay. Yes. I know.
Well, of course, we would be drawn to you because of the topic.
That's true, too, but... Oh, really?
We don't really know much about each other.
Yeah. Is there anyone else who has that situation? Yes?
Yes, I married my father.
Okay.
I have two other children.
Okay. Well, because most of the people here searched, I was interested in talking a little bit about the different experiences and thought processes between the searcher and the person who is found. Because as you could tell from my excerpt at the very beginning of the book, I felt invaded. I felt like the one who was vulnerable. I'm the one who picked up the phone and didn't know who it was going to be. I mean, the intensity level I was expecting, as I said, was a magazine editor, because I was freelancing at the time. That's what I was saying. I didn't think it would be probably the most crucial phone call I'd ever receive. And so I thought I was the vulnerable one. She was the one in control. But then throughout the book, I start to realize how incredibly vulnerable the searcher is. First of all, because the book is a lot about control issues, which I know are predominant in adoptees' lives anyway, but I felt that, you know, I had also the right to decide when to search, that empowering experience of taking those steps of my own volition towards my biological relatives myself, you know, to decide when to do it, to decide how to do it, that was robbed from me. That's how I felt at first, among a multitude of other emotions. But I started to realize that as empowering as that is, and I can imagine that it would be, and some of you can tell me more about how it can be empowering but scary also, you also don't know what you're going to find at the end. And you could very well find someone that you don't relate to at all. You could find someone who is no longer living. You could find someone who rejects you. And especially for the adoptee, that's the quintessential nightmare, that you will be abandoned again. And actually, I haven't gone to many support groups, but I did go to one mainly out of curiosity. And the thing that I gleaned from it the most was that at the beginning, we were asked to go around and explain our stories, a nutshell version of our experience. And after I explained my situation, there was another young woman there. She was probably several years younger than I was, and she was an adoptee. And she said that she felt envious of me for feeling so connected to my adoptive family, feeling so related to them and at home in that family, and also even more for being found by my birth mother, because her experience was that she felt very much like a fish out of water in her adoptive family, which I know happens often with biological children. I mean, in this morning's keynote address, which I thought was just incredible, a lot of what she described I felt was typical teenage rebellion, whether you're adopted or not. But when you are adopted, you have something to latch it onto. You know, the reason I don't get along with my parents is because I'm from somewhere else. And I had never felt that. I actually suspected that I wasn't adopted. You know, this idea of these abstract parents out there, it just didn't really gel for me, because I didn't see in what ways that I wasn't like my family. So in that way, I was very fortunate. On the other hand, perhaps there were a lot of issues that weren't being dealt with, which is probably part of the reason it took me 3 years to be ready for reunion, because there were all these latent issues that I had to grapple with belatedly after 24 years of not. But this woman had felt alienated from her adoptive family, and then she searched for and found her birth mother, who rejected her, who didn't want to see her, who changed her number to an unlisted one. And there are all kinds of reasons for not wanting to be found, and you know, this is such a gray issue, and there's not necessarily clear-cut rights and wrongs. But even, you know, if her birth mother had reasons to protect her privacy or not want to have a connection with the adoptee, it was an incredible affliction for her, and she couldn't get past it. She was having a really hard time with it, and so she felt envious that it wasn't even just that I'd searched and been accepted with open arms. I had been searched for, and she imagined that as a wonderful thing. And so I came away from that support group feeling grateful. It was one of the turning points in this 3-year period for me, where I saw, and that was my birth parents' intention. Actually, of course, they had always been curious, but they had never thought that they could search, that they should search. And they had always hoped that I would search. But then they were in a birth parent support group, and they learned that it could be beneficial for the adoptee to be found, because it breaks that sense of abandonment that the people who left returned, and how encouraging that could be. And then they thought, well, if it's beneficial for her too, let's go ahead and do it. I mean, of course we want to, but let's do it if it's good for her too. So I started seeing how vulnerable this searcher is in terms of not knowing what he or she is going to find, and also that you're automatically putting yourself out there, and you're saying yes and making yourself vulnerable to the possibility that the person who's found will say no. And so the control in some ways is very much in the hands of the person who is found, who decides, yes, I want to be found, no, I don't want to be found, I don't want this contact. So you can look at it in both ways, and I think that both are true. I think that both sides, both the searcher and the person found, are very vulnerable in different ways, and very empowered and in control in different ways. Does anyone have any thoughts about that? Can anyone who searched talk about their experience in terms of mixed feelings of empowerment and trepidation? Yes.
Well, I found my birth daughter by accident.
Oh, God.
Yeah, tripped over, actually, kind of. September 5th, 1998, but who's counting?
Recently.
I did one of the things that I got, my reason for searching, my whole thing was, okay, I've been fed the thing, if she wants to find you, she will.
Right.
There was an automatic air of rejection. That was part of the penalty I paid for giving.
And if she doesn't search for you, she doesn't
want you. Right. I mean, this was just the
party line.
Yeah, kind of, you know. But this was the price you pay.
Right.
Well, one of the things is that one of the things that kind of hit me when you were talking was, when you were talking about not being ready or that they had time to prepare.
Yeah.
You don't. Okay.
Right.
But the thing is that you, I envy kind of the adoptee, because in the cases where adoptees know that they're adopted, they have
their whole life.
Yeah, they have things to deal with. I mean, they know their identity, their nature. Birth moms are secrets.
That's
We're
right.
We're shadow women.
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk about this other than among ourselves. We don't have society dealing with us, or, you know, even now, really. And my thing was, I didn't know what information my daughter had been given. So
right.
I had two things. The explanation of her name, her birth name, which is her family name, it was her great-great-grandmother's name. And the other thing was, I kept the ID bracelet from the hospital.
Oh, God.
And I carried it around for 33 years. And my thing was that if she rejected me, she would be rejecting me out of a truth, not out of a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my tangible way of saying, here, this is what I have kept of you.
Right.
Now, no matter what you were told. And that, to me, that was giving her the power. I didn't ask for anything or have any expectations. I had wants, desires, and dreams.
Sure.
But what I said was that, here, this is how I felt about you. To one, give you a family name, not Tiffany or Barbie or, you know, whatever, you know. But I gave you a family name, and I had carried this for 33 years. It's the only thing I had tangible of you. And if I didn't want you, I would not have had it.
Mm-hmm.
Then, based on her life experience, you know, she could say yay or nay.
Mm-hmm.
That was her.
Right.
Then I gave her that choice.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the only thing that I felt I could do. I had to know that she knew the truth, not a party line or whatever she might have imagined in her, based upon her life experience.
Right. And so you did. When did you make? When did you find her by accident then?
September 5th.
Oh, you said just this past September, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And everything's fine. I mean,
okay.
We are, you know, I mean, when I say fine, we're going the normal ups and downs, the normal,
right.
I think, normal meaning any relationship's going to go, you know, we don't have a map, so we're just sort of stumbling along.
Right.
You know, we don't have a map for it. Nobody
there isn't
how
a map.
Right. Be. But as far as it being an accepted, you know, event, she said thank you for finding me.
Mm.
And so that's all. I mean, no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm. Actually, thank you. You know, just when I gave my birth parents a copy of the book, that's what I wrote in the inscription. Thank you for finding me. Because I wasn't saying that at the beginning, but it was so clear that I was saying that by the end. And so when I inscribed their book, I wrote, thank you for finding me.
Because I don't think that thank you either means forever or it doesn't empower a whole lot of things. It means thank you for putting these pieces together.
Yeah.
You know, for giving me and you know, making that connection, and then you go from there, whatever way, you know,
right.
that you do, but,
right.
Yeah, that's all I see her, I don't have any, still don't have any expectations of her.
When you told her name, to me, and you mentioned your name, and
yes.
you talked about it in your book elsewhere, too, that you look in the mirror and you see that name, and that when I found out my birth name, it was particularly empowering to me, and it was an amazing thing, my name, that has always been for me, never felt like a Renee.
Oh, really?
Mine was Kathy, Susie, Barbie, IE name, and I heard it was Renee. And I grew into it and I liked it. But then in the 70s when I grew up, Chris Everett was very popular, and my friend's name was Kristen. So whenever we played house, my name was always Christy. And then I found my birth mother, and my birth name is Christina.
No!
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, God. Christina Beata Polini. And such an ethnic name, you know, Italian, and I identified with it just so immediately. I just wondered how your daughter feels about this name that you say for her.
She doesn't talk. We have not, one of the things we have not done yet, we are reunited, but we have not talked. When she was first out here, we did superficial, like, things.
Oh, activities.
Yeah, you just did things.
Right.
We have yet to really, really talk.
Mm.
That's what I feel. That there's a ton. And I think she feels it too, when we do, she lives in Alabama, I live in Seattle, so that's not very, you know. And she says, when are you coming out? When are you coming to stay with me? You know, she wants to come.
Mm.
And we want to stay, and we want to spend time, because we had other people around us, and she were other, you know.
Yeah,
we put her on TV.
Oh, there you go. There's an activity.
Yeah, the first day, you know, the next day was Thursday, you know, so we had to have
right.
the interview.
And so we,
right.
But we need to go somewhere. We actually, I'd like to take her and go to, in fact, I'm thinking about seeing if she'll meet me somewhere neutral. Like in a place where we don't know anybody.
Hmm.
And it's just us, and not even a place that has places to sightsee. Maybe Kansas. Maybe Iowa, you know, somewhere in the middle
of nowhere.
We don't have to do anything. That there's nothing else but just
nothing to explore but each other and your relationship.
And I don't know whether she'd be receptive to that, but I feel very strong.
It sounds like if she's encouraging you to come out, that it's deeper than just let's go to the mall, you know. She what?
She is so like me,
isn't she? God.
She is just like, and she tells me, she says, Mom, and she calls me Mom. And she's,
really?
Yeah. She says, face it, I'm just your little clone.
Wow.
Because she is more like me than my captain.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting. Sometimes that's the case, sometimes it isn't. Yeah, you
I was going to talk about the ambivalence or whatever, or the vulnerability of searching.
Right.
I searched, but I searched through an agency, and they served as the intermediary. But once they found my birth parents, they gave permission to tell me that they were married. So I knew very quickly that they were married.
Okay.
And so I had high expectations that they would respond like your birth parents, like, oh my God, you know, here's our long lost daughter, you know, let's get on the next plane, you know.
Mm.
I expected them to have the reaction like your birth parents, and so it was incredibly difficult and painful when they were incredibly reluctant to contact me. They had more of a reaction like you had. They wanted, you know, they wrote me some letters. Hope, and in the letters that they were very clear, hope this will be enough for you, you know, have a nice life. And they did not want to meet me, and they were very clear that they did not want to meet me. And it was only through my persistence that they agreed to meet me, because they felt like I wouldn't go away.
And they do have other children?
Six.
And the children know about you?
They didn't at that
time. They
didn't,
okay.
And so it took... Now, it took what seemed like a lifetime then, this was 12 years ago, 5 months from the time they found out about me until we actually met.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, that was a very long
mm-hmm.
5 month period. And even between the letters at the beginning, they sent the initial letters, like I said, and thought, okay, you know, we're done with her. They sent a couple of little pictures. They even cut somebody out of the picture, you know, like, anyway.
Too much information, yeah.
Yeah, and so... then I wrote back, and I had to write through the agency who forwarded the letters.
Oh.
And then they waited like 6 weeks to respond. So you talk about going to the mailbox every day and my heart breaking every single day. And then in my first letter to them, I had sent some stuff to the agency that they got, but the first actual letter, I suggested meeting right away in neutral spot in their...
between, you know, and they wrote, they took 6 weeks to respond, and then they said, no, you know, we're busy. And so that was very heartbreaking. And so then I wrote back and said, take as long as you need, you know.
Be accommodating adoption.
Yeah, and I was, you know, I said, you know, I've waited 33 years, you know, what's a few more weeks, you know, or months or whatever, you know. And so anyway, then this kept on, and then they waited 6 weeks. They were on their way to a 6 week trip to Spain when they first sent me those letters. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't imagine that they could go off to Spain without coming to meet me, you know, hello. So anyway, it took a long time to process the fact that these people did not want to meet me.
Yes.
And so then when I'd finally given up hope that they would ever agree to meet me, they send this letter and they could meet me the next weekend. I mean, it was very odd. And so
it was sudden when it finally happened.
But I think what happened was the holidays were approaching and they thought, let's get this bitch off our plate. You know, and that was sort of the. So we met in Phoenix. They lived in LA at the time and I lived in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
So we met kind of in the middle. They still wouldn't tell me their names. I only knew their first names when we met in Phoenix. And they were an hour later than what I knew they were going to be. So I'm sitting in my hotel, you know, and my throat's closing up, thinking these people are not going to show up. Right. And so anyway, it was incredibly, I mean, I'm not really giving you a good picture of that period of time, but it was an incredibly difficult 5 months. And then when they did meet me, again, they thought, okay, well, this is great. You know, now she'll go away. And anyway, they made it very clear from the very get-go that they were not interested in me being a part of their family. I mean,
yeah. And like you said, because you knew they were married, you thought their reaction would be very different. I mean, in my case, I really wanted to slow things down, but I always felt that it was a means towards an eventual reunion. So it wasn't to placate them. I mean, I was very honest with them. I wasn't just sort of giving them, you know, throwing them a bone or something like that, because I really wanted to know my birth parents, and I wanted to before they found me. You know, I was, as I said, I was always interested in searching someday, but I was honest on the phone with my birth mother when I said it never occurred to me that I'd pick up the phone and it would be you, because I always thought I would be the one making the call. I didn't have a feeling about it one way or the other, because it had never crossed my mind. I didn't know it would take 3 years when I suggested let's start a correspondence. But it just turned out that way, and the correspondence, it never felt to me as though it were in a stasis, as though we were treading water. It always felt as though it were moving forward, and actually it picked up momentum in terms of the number of exchanges that we had in the third year as compared to the first year. Were much, much greater. By the third year, we were having at least one exchange a month. Usually, I wrote them a letter addressed to both of them, and then they each wrote me a separate letter that they sent together in a single envelope, and we would have at least one of those a month. And the first year, I probably wrote them twice, maybe, and that's all. I just wanted to make one other point that you made me think of, which is when I say at the beginning that I felt that the decision to search when and how to do that was taken away from me, that was knowing that I had birth parents who would want to know me, you know. And so I could imagine, having already been found by a loving couple, that if I had searched, they would have welcomed me with open arms. Of course, if I actually had searched, that would have been a great unknown, and as I said earlier, that would have been my vulnerability as the searcher, not knowing that I would have been accepted at all, let alone by. It was so clear to me, you know, that you know, as I said here, even in the first conversation, I felt warmth towards my birth mother. I felt that I wanted to protect her, like from the fact that my mother had died. I felt bad to convey that piece of information to her. I already felt something so positive from them, and so it was with 20/20 hindsight that I thought, well, I didn't get to search because I knew it would have had a happy ending, even from the get-go. Okay, yeah.
I'm sorry, I wondered if you could give us a synopsis of what finally happened in Denver and after.
We met in Phoenix, and
right.
One of the first things my birth mother said to me was that she was glad she got rid of me. And
my God.
And they have made it, we are no longer in communication, but And I, but at my behest, a couple of years ago, I finally wrote him a letter saying, they could never accept me as anything more than their words, not mine, their very special friend from Texas. And they would introduce me to people that way. And when they could have just introduced me as Catherine Williams, I mean, there was no need to add that hideous little phrase. And so, and none of my siblings have, I've met five of the six. One refused to meet me during the entire 10 years of contact. Mm-hmm. And none of the siblings has even so much as asked a single question about my life, how we are alike, how we are different. I mean, it's been a phenomenal experience. And of course, the foreshadowing was in all of that initial sort of delay and, mm-hmm. and, you know, I mean, that really should have told me everything I needed to know. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, early on, you're not welcome in our home at the holidays. And but yet they, one of the reasons I finally wrote them the letter that I did was they made it very clear that I was not welcome at any of their events, but they would call me up and tell me details of all these family gatherings, down to the menu of what was served and who was there.
You're not invited, but we'll tell you all about it.
And at their 40th wedding anniversary, my birth mother, this was actually what did it, she called me up after this and told me about their 40th wedding anniversary party, which I would have had no expectation to attend. But she said to me on the telephone, all of my children were in attendance.
Hmm.
I wonder what caused the heart so much.
Yeah, I have no idea. But anyway, so that is the... But to say that to me, I mean, you know, to say that to a neighbor...
If they needed to do that, I mean, it's a shame that they needed to do it even for themselves, but if they needed to make that distinction, you know, make it clear that this is the choice we made, it's in the past, this is the family we have, but then to convey it to you, it seems unnecessary.
Yeah,
So how have you dealt with that reaction to finding them? I mean, in yourself, how have you dealt with their reaction?
Well, I mean, obviously, when I read your book, I sobbed where I had, you know, I was soaking wet from, you know, tears, just because those were the letters that I, and those were the feelings that I wanted my birth parents to have. And so it just broke my heart, you know, and I understand that my birth parents are a generation of older than your birth parents, and so that generation by its very nature is more closed down,
right,
and shut down to their feelings, you know, but it still is just incredibly heartbreaking. And so probably before I read your book, I felt like I'd sent this letter and I'd sort of, you know, put it on the shelf and, you know, my life was going on, and then I read your book and sobbed until I couldn't see straight, and then I said, well, maybe I'm not all buttoned up after all. You know, I mean, it was an incredible experience to read that book, and probably more so than any of the books I've read, because it was so poignant and so on point to, you know, we're like flip sides. So.
Right. Yeah. But I hope that my reaction didn't seem... completely similar to you. Well, I mean, maybe it was, but
No, not your. No, I meant we're flip sides, that you were found,
right,
and were welcomed, and
right,
I searched and was not welcomed, and
right,
that's what I meant. No,
right.
No. I think your hesitancy, I understood that, like you said. I mean.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You brought up a point about how adoptees, often their identity as being adopted people is out on the table much more than birth mothers' identity as being birth mothers throughout their lives. So in terms of the process that you go through even before either start searching, the adoptee perhaps is going through somewhat of a lifelong process with that, because often people ask me, why did it take you 3 years? And sometimes, actually, birth parents are grateful to the story, because they might have experienced a similar hesitancy in a birth child that they found, and it helped them understand it better. because I hope that it, you know, I do get to this point of gratefulness and love at the end, and so they actually find it encouraging. But others say, why did it take you 3 years? They sounded like such great people. And it was only, I mean, that's what the book explains, why it's taking 3 years. Like I said, there were a lot of issues that I hadn't given much thought to being adopted throughout my life. And so I think that lifetime of issues of being adopted, and also of my mother's death, which I hadn't dealt with very much either, mourning her belatedly, because, as I said, my birth parents' main motivation was what they learned in the support group, that it could be encouraging for an adoptee to be found, to break that cycle of abandonment. But what it succeeded in doing initially anyway, because I hadn't given very much thought to being adopted or to being abandoned or to having birth parents, is it reminded me of their initial abandonment. And so I was just reminded, oh yeah, I was given up. And then it reminded me, oh yeah, my mother died and abandoned me by dying. So I was reacting to both of these abandonments as as a 24-year-old. So it opened all that up for me, and I had to work through all of that before I was ready to take the next step and meet them. And I realized that some people say, how did your birth parents initially decide to search? And they waited, you know, once they knew that it was okay for them to do so, they waited until they knew I'd turned 21. That was just the way they decided to do it. And she called me a month before my 24th birthday. So I realized, well, I mean, it took them 3 years because it was difficult for them to find me. They didn't choose to take 3 years. But I thought they did have 3 years to think about what it would be like to find me, to think about what it would be like to have a relationship with me. And as I've just said, as vulnerable as the searcher is, and I completely appreciate how my birth mother must have felt picking up that phone and hearing my voice and not knowing who she would find, I needed to catch up. And it just by coincidence took me 3 years as well. But I needed that time. I picked up the phone unawares. You know, as difficult as that phone call was to make, she knew who she was calling, or who she, you know, hoped it was the right person. She knew who she was calling. I didn't know who it was when I answered. So my process began at the point of contact. Their process began at the point of embarking on the search. And so I think that has a lot to do with why it took me that long, because it's true, I'm very fortunate in the people who found me. And so it wasn't ever because of who they were that delayed me. It was the issues I hadn't dealt with, and it was, as I say, needing to catch up to the point in the process that they had already gotten to.
I think sometimes, because this is such a big part of our lives, no matter which side we're on, mm-hmm. that we tend to, emotionally or whatever, want to, okay, this is mainstream, this is life, this is our lives, mm-hmm. which are separate, going in separate directions.
Yeah.
I mean, or separate, because we're separate entities, and we don't have any place where the circles have melded.
They're parallel,
birth,
right.
Other than birth.
Yes,
okay?
I say that, yeah.
But
yeah.
Then, okay, then we almost have to jump outside and deal with each other one-on-one. But then how do we incorporate, get back into this stream that is now melding and touching and mm-hmm. and doing this? And it has to do with, because one of the things I was wondering about you, are you cautious about things anyway? Are you a jumper in or risk taker? See? And I'm a jumper in or, okay, let's dive in. If I sink, I sink. If I swim, I swim. You know,
right.
Whatever.
Right.
And fortunately, my daughter is as well.
Okay.
But if we were different,
right.
personality-wise, I just want to say, I think we're really lucky that we are so much
yes.
alike, because we sort of did react to things in the same types of ways.
Yeah, no, I don't...
But if you were more of a cautious
right. anyway.
And examining, want to see everything, and
yes.
hope it doesn't get everything in order before
yes.
you do something,
I am.
See, then that would account
And
for
who knows
it.
Why I am? You know, like, for example, it's interesting because I mentioned in this excerpt that my birth father's... mother also died when he was six.
Mm-hmm.
Total coincidence that we had that in common. He is also an adopted person, because his father had already died when he was an infant. And so he was raised a little bit differently. He was raised by friends of his parents, so it was known, you know, they knew the family. But what's interesting in terms of being similar or different, and I'll talk about this more in the second half about nature and nurture and how all this changed my opinions about that. But at one point in our reunion weekend, he was admitting how worried he was about everything, even the nitty-gritty, I worried that I didn't put out chips and salsa. And from that to, like, I worried that you didn't have enough time with us alone, or too much time with us alone, you know, and not enough time with the kids, you know, the other kids, and you're worrying about everything. And this is right after I had been in my hotel room walking around thinking about the previous day, because I'd arrived on a Saturday. This was Sunday morning before my birth mother picked me up. I was thinking, how did yesterday go? You know, I should have said this, I shouldn't have said that, I wish I'd done this differently. And so he sounded exactly like me, and I thought, is this a genetic trait that I inherited? Is this because we're both adopted people? Or is it just a coincidence, and we're just both that way, and who knows why, you know? The way that we are similar in terms of the way we dealt with our contact is they're both wonderful letter writers. And my birth father actually has a novel that he wrote in the 70s stashed into a desk drawer. And so that was it's a very natural way for me to express myself, and also because I do have this control freak tendency where, you know, I can think about what I'm going to say and I can write it down. And I could get a letter from them and not even open it right away. Sometimes I'd wait a day or two until I had an afternoon and I felt like reading their words to me, and then I could wait until I felt like responding. But also just the act. I know, you see, but I understand that, but it seemed, because I was making these choices for me and what I needed and how slowly I needed to take it, but in retrospect, considering how well our reunion is going, but again, I'll talk about it more in the second part, I think it was also beneficial for them. As much as they would have wanted to drive down to New York that very weekend, I think that getting to know one another gradually through our letters made our reunion that much more successful. And this is for us. I mean, I've talked to people at bookstores, you know, they speak about their experiences after, and they say, you know, I called my birth daughter out of the blue, we saw each other that weekend, it's been 5 years, it's been great. And that was, or I'm not a big writer, and like if I had been your birth mother and you said, hey, let's slow down and write letters, I don't know if I would have been able to like sit down at the keyboard or pick up the pen and paper and do that. Like I'm a talker, I'm someone on the phone, I'm someone face to face. And so that did come naturally to all of us, the act of writing. And so for that I feel fortunate that we had that similarity.
Control for you, did you think?
I think a lot of it had to do with control.
Gaining it back.
You know, a combination of things, the issues that I hadn't dealt with throughout my life being raised, bringing back that sense of control. And to my birth parents' credit, they did take this risk. They did jump out, you know, off the cliff and make the phone call. But then as soon as I said, you know what, and also, by the way, my reaction to the phone calls didn't really happen until my birth father called 3 days later, because then, as I said, the impact of both phone calls hit me at once, and I realized I could pick up the phone unawares at any moment, and it could be someone I don't expect. It could be, and I just happened to be on my way out the door both times, you know, and I can't talk to you right now. I can't do this right now. You know, it's just how I felt, and I needed to have a little more choice in when we would communicate and how.
I read your book, and my daughter, I swear to God, they're related. I don't know. Your mouth.
Yeah,
comes out of her.
But it wasn't to regain control just for the sake of regaining control. Like, well, you called me out of the blue, so I'm going to hold you at arm's length and make you write letters for 3 years. It wasn't that at all. Do you know what I mean?
It evolved.
It ended up taking that long, but it was really what I needed, and it was the pace that I needed. And then, for example, about 6 months into the correspondence, we exchanged photographs, and as the relationship on the page progressed, we were able to express negative feelings as well. You know, I was able to express these feelings. In the initial letters, I didn't. But ironically, as I was starting to work my way out of them, because it was almost an expression of trust that I was able to say, hey, you know, I felt invaded. You know, and the fact that I could say that showed that I felt that much closer to them, because in the beginning, I expressed it a little, but you know, here I was churning inside, and then I'd write this breezy letter about what was happening in my life, and hey, it's great, happy summer, and you know, just very light.
But isn't that a safer way to take risk too? Because you didn't have to look in their eyes when you said, I felt invaded.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, they had time to not go like, God, she did, you know, mm-hmm. they had time to take their
and they could react in private.
Yeah, and then work it out and right. say, and then stand back from it and then come in and give you the answer.
Right.
So that's, you know, there's a lot to be said for that, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as I say, it worked for us. It can be forced. It can be too slow. It can be something that's unnatural if either writing doesn't come, you know, naturally, or taking it that slowly, or being that deliberate. But the letters are very thorough in exploring everything we were feeling and thinking, and it seemed to work for us. That's why I could never recommend. Whenever people ask advice, I say take it at a pace that is comfortable for you, and that might be meeting immediately. I'm sorry, you had a comment.
Yeah, I was just saying, in listening to all this and within my own experience as an adoptee, that when I found my birth parents, they had died before I was able to find
okay.
them, but I've met some aunts and half-siblings and things like that.
Right, right.
And we went through the initial, wahoo, this is unbelievable.
Right.
And now we're in the, oh my God, what do we do with this, and let's not talk
yes.
to each other for a while.
Yes.
Period.
Right.
But it occurs to me that the fact that there's been so much unknown for so long in traditional adoptions is disempowering for everybody, no matter what your personality is.
That's true.
Because we all have different ways. We would have been processing these things all along.
Right.
And it's a tremendous dichotomy, because I hear a birth mother here saying, you know, the adoptee has known that they were an adoptee all along, and I'm hiding in the shadows. And as an adoptee, I'm sitting here saying, but you carry that child around in your body, and there is a reality for you that you can bring.
That's true, too. The idea of being adopted is abstract. Right.
You know, was I found under a rock? Did I drop from the sky?
That's
was I
true.
Bought at the five and dime? and so there's a
right.
different sort of inability to connect with the reality of it until there is a reunion.
Yeah.
And so we're all sitting around going, I'm unworthy to make the first step. I feel invaded.
Right.
No matter
I don't
want
to make them feel invaded.
I don't want to
yeah.
make them to feel that way, or I don't. Nobody feels like they have control, including adoptive parents.
Yeah.
Because
by the way.
Yeah.
Right.
There's,
right.
There's this other mystery fertile person out there that could do what they need
yes.
to.
That's right.
And there's this bond that they know exists that can be very threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And it just strikes me that this whole thing sets people up for a lot of pain and dysfunction.
Yes.
Regardless of where we're all coming
yeah.
from. And the challenge is to approach it ethically and humanely. And I think that the agencies, I live in Colorado, and the agencies there have really come around on that. And
oh, that's good.
The benefit of at least some degree of honest communication and openness to demonize and re-empower everybody.
That's good. And that's really state by state. As you all know, it varies greatly. I'm from New York. So.
I think the hugest thing that is true of searching people, and I kept close contact with a group of people that start searching about the same time that
mm-hmm.
I did,
mm-hmm.
is this huge, overwhelming fear that you cannot define.
Yeah.
You know, you can't say it's fear of rejection, you know, you can't say it's fear of unknown.
Right.
It's just this huge, overpowering thing that drowns you on occasion. Back up to the surface.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and also what you mentioned is common from stories I've heard where you have the reunion and that wahoo experience, oh my God, and then you pull back, which is also that sort of delayed reaction fear, perhaps, jumping right into it and then pulling back. And I think I haven't really done that with my birth family, I think, because the pulling back occurred before the face-to-face reunion. So the pulling back occurred after the initial contact, yes. But then since the reunion, we haven't really, it's one of the chapters in my book, still during the correspondence, is two steps forward, one step back. But since meeting, we haven't really had that. It's just been a steady progression forward. And like you both expressed, there isn't a map, there isn't really a precedent, and it is individual. In forging this relationship and going from the outside of reality, here we are hanging out together, to how are you going to fit into my life and I in yours, and that's a lot of what I'll talk about in the second half.
Oh,
okay. Yeah.
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 The last paragraph was the best in the book.
The very last?
Prepared having children, you can have many children, how you can have many mothers.
Right.
Can I ask you one question?
Sure.
Did you acknowledge Hannah on Mother's Day?
Oh, well, I'm going to read a chapter in this. I feel like I'm selling the second half. I'll talk about it in the second half, to be continued. But I have a chapter. You read it. The chapter Birthday, where I talk about my three mothers and how they each mother me in different ways and affect me in different ways. I did this year. I happened to be calling her that day anyway. Of course, I said Happy Mother's Day. And I kind of, you know, we both sort of laughed or whatever, but what I really think of as her Mother's Day is my birthday, as I say in that chapter. That, and again, maybe that's also loyalty to my mother. That's her day, and I don't want her to have to share it with someone else. But on the other hand, I have had three mothers in my life, and they all affect me. Even my mother, who died, who's, you know, no longer walking around, continues to affect me. And I feel that her Mother's Day is the anniversary of her death. And so I acknowledge her then. And also on the high holidays, on Yom Kippur, I acknowledge her then too. But that Mother's Day is for my mom. My birthday is for Kathy. My birthday is for Hannah, in a way. And sometimes I think we talk on my birthday and we acknowledge how significant that is. And then Nancy's Mother's Day is the anniversary of her death. I guess for me it helps to separate, to acknowledge everyone, but to separate. But it's not that I don't acknowledge her then, but I feel much more significantly about Hannah on my birthday. That's really when she was the only mother.
Yeah.
She was the one. So, I mean, I'd be happy to talk with people informally during lunch, but I think noon is when it ends, so feel free to come back at 1:30. Same bat station.
I think it's 2:00.
Is it 2:00? Ithaca.
Yeah.
Is it 2:00?
Yeah, it is 2:30.
Oh, 1:30? Okay. See, I don't even know.
Oh, it is.